Torjez, session 16. We are starting a whole new book of the five books of the Chumash. And I want to do a thought experiment with you. I want to just ask a question, put a question out there. If you could name the second book of the five books of the Torah, what would you name it? Now remember, if we are going to be good publicists over here, we're going to have good marketing. We want a name, okay, maybe we're not the most catching or the most riveting name, but at least a name which gives a pretty fair description about, you know, the contents of the book that we're about to read. So if we had to come up with names, what would we call it? Well, there's the classic name that we know of. The English translation, they call it the Book of Exodus, the Book of Leaving, the Book of This Way to the Exit. Okay, that would put the emphasis on leaving Egypt, but we know there's so much more that happens in the second book than just leaving Egypt. There's receiving the Torah, there's the Mishkan, there's a lot that goes on. And what word could we use to possibly capture it just right? Well, there are three different names which are given to this second book. Two of them are from Chazal, one's from the Rishonim. And we're going to do them by the one, I think, which to us would probably be the most fitting or the most exciting, and then we'll go to the ones that are a little bit maybe more difficult to understand. So the one I want to start with, just because it really seems to capture the essence of what everything here is all about, is the Ramban. The Ramban calls the second book of the five books of the Chumash the Book of Geula, the Book of Redemption. And there's actually a very deep and beautiful idea in this Ramban, which is the emphasis, as we see, in the non-Jewish world, calling it Exodus, it's all about leaving, but the Ramban says it's not about leaving Egypt. The fact that we left Egypt, I mean, you know, life there wasn't easy. It's good for leaving for a purpose. We were going somewhere. We were trying to accomplish something. The point of the entire book is redemption. So that raises a few interesting questions, which maybe we'll come back to and explore in the Ramban over here, is what's exactly called exile and what's exactly called redemption? Meaning, at which point did the Jews go into exile, and at what point does the redemption begin, and where does it end? So the Ramban talks about that idea with redemption. He's explaining to us why it's called the Book of the Redemption. Leaving Egypt itself wasn't the Geula. That wasn't the whole thing. Until the Jews received the Torah, until the Jews stood at Har Sinai, reached their potential in receiving the Torah, it's still not yet called redemption. And more than that, says the Ramban, until they built the Mishkan, until they built the tabernacle, until they had the Mishkan and the Shechina, God's presence, had a place to rest, to be amongst the Jewish people, it was not yet called that we had reached Geula. And so therefore, it's beautiful. The Ramban takes us from the very beginning of Exodus, of Shmos, of the Book of Geula, the leaving of Egypt, which is the beginning of that process of Geula, of redemption, all the way through to the end, which is the beginning of building the Mishkan. That's why the Ramban calls this second book the Book of... Now, the Netziv brings another name for this book, which is found in the Bahag, the Baal Halachas Gedolos, Rabbi Shimon Kiari, one of the early Gaonim. He calls the book, now get ready for this one, he calls it Chumash Sheni, Chumash number two. Now I know what you're thinking as a publicist, as a marketing guy, you're rolling your eyes, or girl, and saying, Chumash number two? I mean, that's a little bit better than that, right? Just call it Chumash two. And the thing about it, which is really fascinating, which the Netziv points out, is that all the other Chumashim, right, if we're going to call this one Chumash 2, should be Chumash 1, Chumash 2, Chumash 3, Chumash 4, Chumash 5. Okay, it's not creative, but at the very least, it gives us a concept of order, of structure to the five book, the third book. However, those aren't the names that the Bahag gives them. The first book, he calls it Bereshis. Now, Bereshis, that's a great name, right? In the beginning, which is a pretty apt description of what happens over there. The third book, he calls Sefer Kohanim, the book of the Kohanim, right? Makes sense. It's all about the Kohanim. The fourth book, he calls it Chumash Pekudei, because there's a lot of counting that goes on over there, and that's a pretty accurate translation over there, numbers, right? And of course, there are going to be deeper ideas there, which maybe we'll get to when we get to Bamidbar. And the final book he calls Mishneh Torah because of that concept of repeating the Torah. So now the question becomes a little bit more interesting. Well, that's fascinating. Was giving these very descriptive names to every other Chumash in the five books, why is the second one just called? I mean, either just call them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or give them all descriptive names. And the truth is that the Makor for the Bahag, the source that the Bahag is working off of, he's actually coming from Chazal. He's coming from our sages. It's a Gemara, which can be found in Sota, on Daf Lamed Vav. So from that Gemara on Daf Lamed Vav, the Bahag is coming along and giving the name to this Chumash, Chumasheni, book number 2. Now, the Netziv points out there's a third name, which is the one that we know, or the one that we use, that we're comfortable with, which is Shmos, names, which is a name which is given by the Medrash a few different places, calling it the Book of Shmos. And this whole idea of Bereishis Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvarim, that's where it comes from. But the Netziv wants to help us understand why the Bahag has chosen to call this Chumash Sheni. In Rashi's understanding of the word Bereshis, we spoke back then about some of the grammatical problems with the word Bereshis. Rashi brings a Chazal that Bereshis could be understood as for the sake of Reshis, meaning for the sake of the thing which is called Reshis. So the examples that Chazal bring there are Torah and the Jewish people. So the Netziv is bringing together that Chazal and bring it to its full completion, its full understanding. That is to say that the world was created for the sake of the Jewish people and Torah. And so that until the Jewish people haven't yet reached their full potential. And then Netziv says something very interesting over there, how for a regular person, even a secular person, even a non-Jewish secular person, could understand the concept that human beings are not animals. They were created for some greater purpose. If they're not reaching their potential as humanity, then that certainly can't be the fruition of what a human is supposed to be, the ultimate climax of creation. So the Netziv says, so too for a Jew, that completion comes when a Jew has received the Torah. And of course, as the famous verse in Yeshaya tells us, that the Jews are a light unto the nations of the world, that the whole job of the Jewish people is to bring the world into one praises of Hashem, and that's only when they receive the Torah. So the Netziv says that the reason why Chazal have called specifically this book, Book 2, is that you should know that it is the completion of the first book. Meaning there's Bereshis, and there's Bereshis Part 2, which is what we're experiencing over here in the second book. It's the completion of the act that started in the first book of creation, which is only completed at the end of this book when the Jews are standing with the Torah and the Mishkan. Now, the Netziv loves us very much, and so he does not third question that we brought up, why it's called Shmos, the Book of Names. He wanted to leave something left for us to do, and so he does not explain where this concept of calling it the Book of Names comes from. Now, I know that anybody who's listening to this is smart enough to be able to say, well, what do you mean? It's the second word in the book, right? That's why we call it the Book of Shmos. And, you know, that's true, but that seems to be the pattern in the Medrash, that Bereshis is the first word, right? Shmos, the second word. Wherever you find a word early enough in the Pasuk, which sounds is a good catchy word, you could stick it there. I mean, there's two questions really that I would ask on that, which is, first of all, if it's a convenience idea, well, then why is that easier than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Call them Chumash 1, Chumash 2, Chumash 3, Chumash 4, Chumash 5. Isn't that even easier to remember and keep organized than these words? And if you're going to tell me that it's because that's where you know where the book starts, well, you know, even though Bereishis only comes up once in the whole Chumash, but the word Shmos and the word Vayikra and the word Bamidbar and Dvarim appear all over the Chumash. And so it wouldn't be a particularly wonderful indication of where to start the next idea. And so therefore, I would like to believe, it seems, that when Chazal understand that one of these Chumashim should be called Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvarim, that it's not only an indication of where we're starting, but it's also describing to us some essence, some aspect, some idea, a theme that's going to pull us through the entire Chumash and help us understand some aspect, like we see in Bereishis, that there's an aspect of creation that works all the way through it. It's the beginning, not only the beginning of life on earth, but the beginning of civilization, humankind, Judaism. It's all beginning in that first book. That being said, we'd have to understand in what way names is an apt description of the theme of what's happening in this book. And as a matter of fact, there's a book called the Book of Names. The first parsha is actually a little bit strange in that names seem to actually be missing. And we'll talk about that in just a second. I'll bring up that point. But let's just start off with the first verse over here. The first verse says, Ve'ela shmos b'nei Yisrael, aboy mitraim es Yaakov, ishu beis habo. These are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt with Yaakov, a man in his home. They came, and it goes on to list the 12 sons of Yaakov. And then it says, Vayhi kol nefesh yotze yerech Yaakov. Each soul, each life that came from the thighs of Yaakov, the scions, the descendants of Yaakov, Shivim Nofesh, were 70. VeYosef Hayav Mitzrayim, and Yosef was already in Egypt at the time that they came. Now, the first question, just about this word Shmos, the names over here, is that for a description, a historical description, of what's happening over here, the writing leaves a lot to be desired. What I mean is that though we've described everything quite nicely, we understand who's coming, but if you, and you said these were the names of the people who were there, and then you said the names, and that's acceptable on a third grade level. But on a sixth grade level, you already know that if you just say the names, I know that that's their names. You don't have names, and these are the people. I got it, right? You say, my grandparents, so-and-so, did this and that, and I know that those are their names. So why is the verse making such a big deal of telling me these are their names? I know their names. I read Bereishis' first book, and if I wasn't sure that theirs were their names, at the end of Parshas Vayigash, it says these are the names. And not only does it list the 12 tribes, it lists all 70, right? Minus Yocheved, over there, in that list. So I know that those... So why, when starting off this second book, am I told these are the names of the children of Israel and not just told that these were the children of Israel that came down to Egypt? Why that extra, these are their names? And the other thing that you may have noticed, because you're an observant Jew, is that the first time around, in Parshat Vayigash, we're actually told who all said, whereas over here, we're only told the 12 tribes, the 12 sons of Jacob, and then told that there were another 58. And for a book of names, a book which is about the concept of names, I wonder what happened to those other 58 names. How come they don't get mentioned? And you'll notice also that at the beginning of this book of names, there are a lot of people who aren't mentioned. Paro is not mentioned by his name. He's called Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt. It's only much later... Miriam and Yocheved, at the beginning, are not given their Jewish names. They're called by Egyptian names. when we see the wedding between Amram and Yocheved over in the second parak, it's a man from the house of Levi who's a daughter of Levi, and their names are not mentioned. So what's very fascinating here is that until Moshe is born and comes into the picture, people seem to actually be missing names in this book. So for Book of Names, that's another problem. We'd want to see more names, not less names. Okay, that's our question. We'll have to move forward a little bit, and then we'll go back and see if we can understand a little bit more of this concept of what's happening with the names. So if you go over to the beginning of the third Aliyah, Perek Beis, the second chapter, verse 11, Pasuk Yud Aleph, we have this, Vayhi b'yamim ahem, in those days, v'yigdal Moshe, Moshe became great, v'yetzel echav, he goes out to his brothers, v'yar b'sivotam, and he sees them in their burden, in their suffering, v'yar ish mitri make ish ivri me'echav, and he sees a Egyptian man striking a Jewish man. What happens? Moshe looks ko v'cho, v'yifen cho v'cho, he turns to here and to there. He sees ki ein ish, he sees there's nobody. He sees there's no person. V'yachas ha-mitri v'yitmen v'chol, he hits the mitri and he buries him in the sand. Okay, so just basically the way we're understanding the story, and of course we're going to understand the story kipshuto in the simple understanding, is that Moshe goes out. He goes to see what's happening amongst them. He sees an Egyptian striking a Hebrew man. He looks around, he sees them, he kills him, and he buries him. But there are a lot of questions over here in this story, and those are going to come up in the language. And Rashi is going to be over here. So, first of all, what does it mean to see the suffering of the Jews? Rashi says that he put his heart and his soul, his heart and his eyes, he was feeling their pain. He wanted to understand the pain and the suffering that was happening over here. And he sees this officer, right? He's an Ish Mitri, he's an important person. He's an Egyptian officer beating this Jewish man. And we get a whole backstory over here. What was happening? So it turns out that the story was that this Egyptian officer, he was the one in control of telling the Jews when to go out and when to come back for going to do the labor. And he would go sometimes into their homes and throw them out. And in one of these homes, this Egyptian officer, he saw a Jewess by the name of Shlomis Bas Divri. And he was very taken by her. So he came up with a plan. He threw this poor Jew out of his home in the middle of the night. He came in to the house of the Jewess, pretending to be the husband. He had relations with her, and he leaves. Then at some point, the Jew comes back home, and he's talking to his wife, "How was your day? How was your day?" And all of a sudden, they realize that something very unpleasant has happened in their home. They figure out what this plan was of the Egyptian. When the Jew is out in the field, it became very clear to this Egyptian that he was caught, he was figured out. So in response to that, he's making this Jew miserable, making him suffer. The Egyptian was uncomfortable. I don't know, maybe he had low self-esteem. He didn't like that he'd been figured out. And so he was torturing and beating this poor Jew. So Moshe looks ko v'ko, and Rashi, again, bothered probably by this language of ko v'ko. That's not how we say here and there. That's more like this and that. So Rashi tells us he saw what was happening in the house. He saw ko, he saw what was happening in the field. That Moshe, because he was a very spiritually sensitive person, he got Ruach HaKodesh. He had divine inspiration. And he understood the deeper backstory, what was happening between these two people. And it says he looked about and he saw that there was no Ish. That's not how we would say no one was around. If you would say that there was no ish in the area, there was no ish around, that's fine. But here it just says that there was no ish. Another interesting problem is that we're about to find out that people did see it, right? So it seems like people were around. So what does it mean that there was no ish? Rashi explains that Moshe was able also, no person, no Jew, no one would, Egyptian, through the whole time of leaving Egypt, no good would come out of him. And so Moshe understands him and he buries him in the sand. And it's just very interesting that throughout this entire confrontation, this entire story, there's a dual storyline running in Rashi, and we're actually going to see that it's going to continue, and we're going to reach the peak of that with a very breathtaking, very stunning Gur Aryeh. So Rashi has the simple story as we see it. Moshe goes out, he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew, he doesn't like it, kills him, buries him, next. Rashi says there's a drush story going on, there's a deeper story going on that you need to know, which the verse moves us towards because of the grammatical challenges, which is that Moshe understood this whole backstory happening between this Egyptian man. He sees that the Egyptian has no spiritual potential, and therefore he buries him in the sand, which, by the way, this isn't in Rashi, but it's, because in the Pshat it's understood why he buried him in the sand. He buried him in the sand because they were in Egypt, but of course that's the same reason why the verse didn't have to say it. The verse could have said he buried him, and because you're in Egypt, you'd understand that it was the sand. But again, sand, this idea of chol, is this idea of chul, the idea of things which are not holy, mundane, of no spiritual significance. Sand, unlike earth, nothing grows in it, nothing can come out of sand. It's not a bar gibul. It doesn't stick together, it can't become unified the way that earth does. Sand scatters easily. Everything about sand shows a lack of spirituality as opposed to earth, which is filled with potential for spirituality. So Moshe buries this Egyptian in the sand, a representation of the fact that he lacks spirituality. And he sees two Hebrew men, two Jewish men, quarreling. And Rashi says to the one, look, wicked one, fellow man, why, right? The one had his hand up to strike the second one. He said, why would you do that? And the response, which Moshe gets, is a little bit stunning. They respond to him and said, who put you as a man, as an officer and a judge over us? Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? And Moshe was scared. And he said, now I understand the matter. So what happened? Moshe goes out. He sees these two Jews in a loving, concerned way. He says, hey, what's going on? Don't you guys love each other? And the one turns and says, whoa, what are you going to do? You're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? And Rashi, of course, comes to explain to us that when we see that Moshe is scared, it means simply, well, he's scared that the word has gotten out, right? And he says, v'chen odadavar, now he understood that Paro is going to find out and it's time for him to scram. He's got to run. But Rashi is also going to tell us the parallel drush story that's going on over here. And it could be the reason why Rashi understands that there must be some parallel story over here is because the Chumash does not need to tell us what Moshe was feeling. Right? It's very odd that the Chumash says, well, he was in a giddy mood that day. Oh, he was a little bit embarrassed. You know, why don't... And then the verse goes on to say, and he said to himself, the matter is known. Well, if you just go to the verse finds out and he wants to kill Moshe. So we could just eschew this entire portion of Moshe being scared and saying, well, the matter is known. And we would just say, Paro found out, Moshe ran away. We'd know that the matter was known and he was scared. We're parallel story going on over here. And these Rashis are just unbelievable, and I'll say them, but then we're going to have to go back and really think about them because they're pretty earth-shattering. So Rashi says, Vayar Moshe was scared. Kapshuto, right? Just like you would think. He was scared because he was found out. But now he brings the Medrash, the exegetical interpretation. Moshe was nervous that he saw that amongst the Jewish people there were wicked Delturin, right? Delturin are squealers, rats, tattletales. Moshe saw that there were the Jewish people. Okay, tattletales, that's not a good thing. So Moshe says, now maybe the Jews aren't fitting to be redeemed. That's the first Rashi. Rashi says Moshe was scared. Why was he scared? Because when he saw the way that these two Jews behaved, right? The Medrash tells us that these were Dasan and Aviram. When he saw the way that Dasan and Aviram behaved, he said, whoa, there are those type of people in the Jewish people? There are tattletales? There are snitches in the Jewish people? Oh, my goodness. Maybe they don't deserve to be redeemed because of that trait. And the next Rashi, Achen noda hadavar kimashma'o, Rashi is right, like you would implies, that the whole matter was known to Paro. Umidrasho, but there's a citation, nodali hadavar sheiti tamelav, I finally understand that thing that always bewildered me. I never understood it. Ma chatu Yisrael makol shivim umos. What did the Jews do? More than the 70 nations of the world. Liot nirdim be'avdus parech. To be forced to do this cruel, unusual, difficult labor. Avaroni ro'ani shehem ro'ing l'kach. But now I see they deserve it. Whoa. Whoa. That's a whoa. What is going on in this Rashi? Moshe says, I'm scared the Jews don't fit to be redeemed. But now I understand why they've been suffering so much. And why? Because they're snitches. Because they're tattletales. Okay, we can all agree it's not good to be a snitch, right? It's not good to be a tattletale. If you were in first grade and you snitched on me, I might throw dirt in your face. But there were other things going on in the Jewish people that were probably, you know, worse than that. It's not like they were all eating Mahadran kosher food over here. It's not like, you know, they were all going to shul and davening three times a day. And, I mean, there was idolatry going on and they were eating non-kosher food. And they're, right? These Jews were not Jews of Torah and Mitzvahs. These were the Jews of Egypt. That's the worst thing, that there were tattletales, that there were snitches. This is why the Jews deserve to suffer in Egypt. And not just suffer horribly. Back-breaking labor. Their children were being thrown in the river. Moshe says, oh, I get it. And the Gur Aryeh over here, the Maharal, on this verse, understanding this Rashi, says something which on its surface is very simple. But when we get to the deeper idea, something that one could spend a lifetime deepening and prodding and going into this idea. And it's an idea which is a major idea, not only of the Maharal, but a lot of the commentaries, which is pretty central to all of the Torah. The Maharal says like this. The Maharal says, Moshe was nervous they wouldn't be fitting for Geula. Geula, redemption, which is something which is pnimi ve'elyon. It's internal and it's very elevated. It's a very high thing. It's a very high internal matter. Galus, right? Slavery, egg is very shafel v'chitzoni. It's very low, it's very external. And also, being Dalturin, someone who speaks Lashon Hara, someone who's a gossip, someone who doesn't know how to hold on to a secret, that's something which is very low and external. Jews are supposed to be very internal and very elevated. They were behaving very low and very external. Therefore, it came out, right? God revealed their true nature, which was to be in exile. Now, the Maharal goes a little bit in length to describe this idea, and he said, the reason I've taken so much pains to go into depth to help you understand this idea, he says, this is, as Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, this is the number Jews struggle with, and says the Maharal, I need you to understand it, because it's what keeps us in the exile. And if we can appreciate this point, okay. So let's try to understand a little bit what it's all about. We spoke a little bit, previously we'd spoken about life in Gan Eden, what life was like for Adam HaRishon, what life was like for the first man. The first man had a very holy, spiritual life, even though he was living in a physical world. He was living in a physical world, but his spiritual essence was so strong, light shone out through his skin, even all the way down to his ankles. His ankles were like the sun. The most physical part of him burst forth with spirituality. He was walking constantly with the Shekhinah, with God's presence, was always with him in the Garden of Eden. So it was a physical place, but a holy spiritual existence. And one of the first jobs that Adam Rishon had, which we spoke about, was naming the different animals, right? God brings in the animals, and Adam gives them names. And it says over there was through naming them that he realized that he did not have a partner. And so Rashi explains that it wasn't just naming them like you would think it was naming them. He was actually understanding the spiritual essence, right? When we think about names, and this is important since that's what names are a way for us to classify things, right? Genus, class, kingdom, remember all that stuff? Why do we give names? Because when I want to understand something, it helps me to categorize things into groups as a point of reference, so I know what we're talking about. But when Adam gave names to the animals, he didn't call a dog because of some sort of external characteristic or because it was an easy word to say and he liked it. It's because Adam was on such a high spiritual level that he was able to see into the spiritual depths, the reality of a dog. This was an animal who was either kalev, it was like a heart, or kolev, depending which way you want to understand it. And that's why a dog looked and behaved the way it did. A peel was a pele, right? That's why a peel looks as every animal he was able to see into its spiritual DNA and to understand what the essence of that animal was. Which means to say, a really remarkable idea, that had Adam HaRishon, the first man, been a Darwinist, a Darwinian, someone who believed in the philosophies of Darwin, he would have looked at a monkey and he would have thought maybe that was a fitting partner for him, because if he was looking at the physical DNA, right, there's very slight variance between a monkey's DNA and our DNA. But Adam HaRishon was looking at the spiritual DNA and he understood spiritually that a monkey and a man are two wholly different things. And so therefore, Adam HaRishon could not find a partner in the Garden of Eden until God created Chava. So we see that the life of total spirituality, filled with a deep spiritual connection to things, and this notion of speech, of speaking, the ability to give things names. It's what makes man unique, and we see that our sages call man in a few different places Madaber, right? What makes man unique, the Kuzari, right, speaks about man as Madaber. He's the highest level, the level of speech. And we would think, well, aren't there other things that express the greatness of man more than speech? So we have to realize that speech is not what an African gray parrot does. Naming 318 different things that the researchers at MIT give you, that's not called speech. The power of dibur, what we speak about, is the ability to express things in an abstract manner. That is to say that you and I could sit down and have a conversation of toy trucks without you putting it in my beak. An African gray parrot can't do that. It has to have some sort of a trigger, right, for the memory, for the direct recall of the sound that goes with that object. And that every animal has, right? Every animal has a sound for danger. Every animal has a sound for food. Well, not every animal, but the ones that do. But that's not speech. Speech is the ability for you and I to sit down and talk about anything without having to see it in front of us, just to speak about it conceptually. So in a way, we see this is the expression of what Adam HaRishon was doing. We can talk internal idea, the spiritual concept of a table, without a table physically. And those who are into semiotics, which is the study of symbols, sometimes like to use a distinction between the way speech of people and the speech of animals, in that animals have an environment and people have a world. That is to say, animals are responding directly to the environment that surrounds them, whereas people live in an entire world of symbols and ideas. So we're going to go with the Chazal phrase for this, phrase that our sages use, which is the Olam HaPnimi. A person has an Olam HaPnimi, he has an inner world. It's a world that you can't see or touch, but it's a world that he builds and he creates inside of himself. And that's why if you say table to me and you say table to somebody else, we may draw two very different tables. If you said table to me and someone living in Japan and someone living in Africa, tables would not look the same, because in our Olam HaPnimi, we have a different way to relate to table, even though we could all tell you abstractly that at the root of it, a table is some sort of a platform, right, where you could place things on top of it, usually elevated off of the ground. Now, an animal only has an olam hachitzoni. He only has an external world, a world that he can touch and feel and see. And the reason why it's important, why the whole maila, why the greatness of man is that he has the power of speech, because the power of speech is the ability to express that inner world. The inner world, the world of thought, that's where spirituality lives and exists. That's why animals don't speak. Not because of evolution, because animals, they're not linked up to the spiritual world the way that we are, which is the world of thoughts and the world of concepts. And the reason man needs to be linked up to that world is to do good, to be good, to be able to understand right from wrong. He has to be able to live in a world of concepts. He has to be able to have that inner space, that inner reality, where he has the ability to create a reality that he can choose from right and wrong. And we see that Adam was deeply, the first man was deeply entrenched in that Olam HaPnimi, because everywhere he looked, he saw it. He saw the spiritual roots of everything. Now, when Adam Rishon sinned, he left Gan Eden, and his reality was very different after that. He was not living on the same spiritual level. He was a whole different creation almost in the way that he was able to relate to or connect to spirituality. And I'm going to bring this idea from the Derech Hashem. The Ramchal says over there in Chelek Beis, Perek Dalet, that even though man was exiled from the Garden of Eden, Hashem still wanted his offspring to be able to connect back to Gan Eden. Now, reaching that level, attaining that level that Adam was on, originally he was just born into it. It was very natural. Now the path would have to be worked for. It would have to be earned. And hundreds of years go by, and the first person who's able to actually work his way back to create a connection to Gan Eden, Abraham is the one who creates that path back to Gan Eden for himself and for all of his offspring. Because Avraham is able to get back of Adam Arishon, of living in a physical world, but seeing the spiritual roots, the spiritual depths of everything, living in that Olam Hapnimi, in that inner world, everywhere. Avraham is called the forefathers, or the three fathers, who are forefathers, are called the Mizbeach, right? They're called the altar, they're called the Merkava. They're the physical connection in this world to spirituality. So the book of Shmos is the continuation of that story. It's the continuation of Avraham's story. We're not continuing Esau's story. We're not continuing Yishmael's story. We're continuing Avraham's story. Because the function of man wasn't for the Olam Hichatzoni. It wasn't for the physical world, where Esau and Yishmael excelled exceedingly well. If you look at their successes, right, and you looked at the success of the Jewish people up until the point of leaving Egypt, well, you would think that the one to write the book about are the offspring of Esau or the offspring of Yishmael, who were dominating the world physically. But the purpose of man wasn't to dominate the physical world. It was to connect the physical world to the Olam HaPnimi, the internal world, the world of connection with spirituality and the world of connection with Hashem. And that world only reaches its fruition in our book, in the book of Shmos, in the second book. He finally created for the world to reach back into Gan Eden, to get back to that place of spiritual connection. Now we're going to just take a quick aside and move back, right? But that's why this is Chumash 2. It's the completion of that story. And the reason why names are missing over here, or why there's a problem of 12 names and not the other 58, is because chronology of the Jewish people. It's not a history lesson. It's not. That's why we don't say these are the children of Yaakov. This is why we say these are the names of the children of Yaakov. We need to understand that these are 12 spiritual realities of the Jewish people. These aren't 12 sons. These aren't 12 people. These are shemos. These are names. Just like a peel, a kof, a kelev, a para, a shor, all represent a spiritual reality, so too, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, these are all representations of a spiritual reality. Yaakov doesn't have 12 children because that's what his insurance would cover. Yaakov has 12 children because there are 12 aspects of the spiritual reality which is called Yaakov. This isn't a history story. This is a story about spiritual development. That's why, by the way, the other 58 don't get named over here, because they're the base Yaakov. These are the house of the 12. They are under that spiritual reality, each one of whatever their home is, whether the home is Yehuda, whether the home is Reuven, Asher, Gad, Naphtali, whatever it is, they are under that idea. And that's why Rashi over here is a very beautiful Rashi that opens the book of Shmos, the book of Names, where Rashi is trying to understand, trying to explain to us why we're going back and restating the names that we've already said once before. Why is this counting, this renaming all happening once again? Hello, we've seen this. So Rashi brings a medrash that just like Hashem names the stars when he takes them out and puts them back in. That is to say, as the stars move through the sky in the different seasons, fulfilling their different purposes, Hashem gives names to these stars, it says, as they come in and they go out. Okay, so very nice. Rashi has this idea that Hashem gives names when things start and when things end. So too, when the tribes are living, we name them once, and when they reach their completion, when they pass away, we name them again. But of course, it's not a coincidence that Rashi picks the metaphor of the stars. The Chazal pick the metaphor of the stars. Our sages are extremely specific when they talk about stars. There's a lot of things, and well, not our star. The verse is very specific because there are a lot of things in outer space. It's not just stars. There's space gas, nebulas, meteorites, space debris. I guess meteorites, space debris. But the idea is that why specifically are we talking about stars? And stars are actually really remarkable in one way. That if there was any physical thing that could represent spiritual reality in the physical world, stars would be that thing. For example, as we pointed out with Bayakov, our sages used the reference of suns, that his ankles were like two suns. A star is pure energy. It has almost no physical form. Meaning, obviously there is a physical nature, but when you look at the physical world, combustion, pure energy bursting forth is just about as not physical as you can get. It's pure energy and it seems to be eternal. It seems to have a constant existence. The idea of a star, you look up at it, it seems to be in a fixed place in the sky. This time next year, you'll find it here in the same place, always to guide your way, to guide your path. And just like there are 12 constellations, there are 12 mazalos, right? We know that mazal doesn't mean luck. Mazal comes from the Hebrew word lenazel, to drip, right? The concept of a star, not the physical stars, but the spiritual essence behind that star, the names of the stars that we're speaking about, are the way that, right, obviously we're talking in deep spiritual terms and we're expressing them very simply, that Hashem expresses different aspects of his will in the world, different times of the year, working through the different constellations. Now, even though there are 12 constellations, just like there are 12 tribes, there are obviously billions of stars. And the stars move with the constellations. But the constellations are the essential aspect. They're the ones that get the shame. The other stars work together through those constellations. So too, the other 58 people, and then eventually the whole of the Jewish people, are divided into these 12 spiritual realities. That's why the Jewish people moved in tribal units through the desert, why they stayed there when they came to the land of Israel, because there were different areas of the land of Israel which were spiritually appropriate for people who came from that spiritual root. So we start with this concept of the names of the children of Israel, because it's not about the physical people who went there, but about a spiritual reality which is taking place, that the totality of Yaakov, the complete man, is coming down, represented by himself with the 12 aspects, as we see as the tribes, with the homes that number 70 in parallel to the 70 nations of the world. And that aspect of them is already not about their specific name, but about more their greater function. And that's also why there are certain names missing in the continuation of the Book of Names. Because when we speak about the king of Egypt, we're not speaking about Paro as an individual in his source had something against the Jewish people. But that in general, Hashem wanted this event to happen at this point in time. And so we speak about the Melech Mitzrayim. We speak the other way. We speak about the spiritual influence over Egypt is what's pushing this event forward, not Paro himself as an individual acting on his own roots. And again, we see it too with Yocheved and with Amram, with Moshe's parents. If we speak about them by names, you might think it's because of Amram, because there's something about who he was in his source. It's because of Yocheved, who she was, that's why we get Moshe. But the Parsha very specifically leaves out their names to show you that it was time to bring Mashiach, and therefore Moshe was born. It wasn't about the spiritual essence of Amram and Yocheved that brought about Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our Master, our Redeemer. Okay. This is also why, as we mentioned, that Moshe's whole story has a double reality to it. It has a double existence. When Moshe goes out to sea, he's not going out with physical eyes to look at the suffering of the Jewish people. Right? He's not a sociopath. He's not a masochist. That's why Rashi sees he's going out to sea with his heart. Moshe wants to understand what is the spiritual underpinning of the suffering of the Jewish people. This is why Moshe says, I was always troubled. Now I understand. Because Moshe lives in that world of connection to spirituality. And when there's suffering around him, Moshe wants to understand what's the spiritual source for this suffering. Where is Hashem in this picture? And because Moshe is so connected to this concept, he's so connected to this world, and everything he sees, he's looking for the ko v'ko. Well, is this part of the Geula story? Is this something personal between the Egyptian man and the Jewish man? Or is this part of God's plan? And he's looking into the Ish, right? Well, is this person part of God's story? Is some great spiritual potential going to spring forth from this Mitzri? Is he going to contribute to the Olam HaPnimi? Or is he just going to birth another person to the Olam HaChitzoni? Is he going to reach, help humanity reach its ultimate fruition? Or is he not? And so Moshe brings about this amazing Chiddush to us. This Einfalt. This anagnorisis, this epiphany. Although, I like the word Chiddush. This Chiddush that you could want Mashiach now. But if Mashiach's going to come, you have to create the reality in which Mashiach can exist. You have to bring yourself to Geula. You have to be connected to spiritual reality, which is redemption, which is Geula. We see it in our day-to-day reality all the time that there are all sorts of people in this world. There are those who live in this world and they see it as Gehenna. And there are those who live in this world and they see it as Gan Eden. And that's what Moshe saw in these two Jews. He saw two people who were living in the Olam HaChitzoni. And what happens when you live in the Olam HaChitzoni? What happens when you're a Rochel? What happens when you're a Megale Sod? Is that you are being a tool for the environment around you. What do I mean? You see another person do something which is wrong. You take that information and you pass it over to the next person. Hey, did you see what so-and-so did? That's called being a rochel. That's called speaking Lashon Hara. You're being a Megale Sod. You're revealing something. Now, what that also means is that you were actually not much of a part of this equation at all. You were just a vessel to pass the information over from point A to point B. But it never went through the filter of your Olam HaPnimi. You never looked at it and tried to understand, what am I looking at over here? When you see a person do something which looks wrong on the surface, the first thing you have to do is you have to say, whoa, slow down. Wait a minute. What am I watching? Who is this person? What's the reality? What's the situation? Are there pieces of the story that maybe I'm missing? And let's say you even feel like you have the whole story and you understand who this person is. But there's another question. Do I benefit? Does anybody benefit from me revealing this information to the next person? Moshe was coming out to try to help the Jewish people. That's why he was there. And these two Jews, Dasam and Aviram, see this event. And they just pass on the information to the next person. They don't internalize it. And what that means is that when you don't internalize it, basically the external world dictates to you what reality is. And if the external world is dictating to you what reality is, it means that you are already in shibud. You're already a slave. You are enslaved to reality that you cannot change. However, if a person is connected to the Olam HaPnimi, if he's connected to his internal world, he can see things happening in the outside world, and he determines what the reality is. What's happening? What am I seeing? And when he determines what the reality is, he's in Geula. He's free. No matter where he is or what's happening to him, if he can find the spiritual reality of what's going on, he can be in prison and he can be free. But if he lives in the Olam HaChitzoni, he could be free and he could really be in prison. So Moshe understands that all Hashem was doing was, because the Jewish people were meant to be Pnimi, but they were following the influences of their masters, they were being like the Mitzrim, who come from the word Metzarim, those who have a constricted view of reality. Everything needs to be connected to the material world. Because they were rejecting that, God was lifting up the curtain and he was saying, look, you're living in a world of shibud. You're living in a world of being enslaved. But if you could connect to me, if you could connect to your internal world, if you could find spirituality, if you lived in the Olam HaPnimi, you processed the events that you were watching and tried to see how they fit into the bigger picture, you would already be living in Geula. Oh, the Musar that comes out of this sort of thing is obviously massive and can be taken in a lot of different directions. One place where I think about this a lot is when I was running Maor trips. One of the things that we used to do was we used to go to Yad Vashem. And it's very hard when you go with someone through Yad Vashem. I remember it from my own youth. You go through and it's very moving and you're very disturbed and you're very confused. And the question you have to ask yourself is, well, I experienced something here, but what am I learning? What am I taking out from it? And, you know, in trying to create a dialogue, different possible viewpoints, one of the things that I started to take out of it was that when you heard the stories of Jews living in the Holocaust, which was the closest thing to Gehenna on earth that we could imagine, and yet they were so deeply connected to spiritual reality. Jews who were risking their life for a pair of tefillin to make matzah, right? The story of the Bachram, of the young men who are being walked to the gas chambers, and one of them turns around and says, Yidden, my fellow Jews, do you know what day it is today? It's Simchat Torah. And they started dancing and celebrating on the way to the gas chambers. And there's no greater embodiment of the notion that we're discussing right here than that a person could be in the worst gullus, but he could personally be in Geula. So the Ramban explains, as we said, that Geula was the time and place when we're with the Mishkan and the Shekhinah is with us. We see that according to Ramban, exile doesn't mean leaving the land of Israel, and redemption doesn't mean coming back to the land of Israel. Exile means you're not with the Shekhinah, you're not connected to spirituality. Redemption means you've created the possibility to live with the Shekhinah, to live deeply connected to spirituality. So we see that the book of Shmos, the book of names, is aptly named because just like it's the second book of creation, it's the completion of a world which Adam was not able to complete, of creating an entire community which will eventually create an entire world, which goes back to find the inner world, the connection to Hashem in the physical world. That's what the second book is. It's not an exodus, It's not a trip out of something. It's a pnimius. It's a trip into something, into our own souls, to try to find and try to reveal Hashem. And of course, this is done with the receiving of the Torah, right? The Torah, the Mishkan is that place, but the Torah is the way that each person can be a Mishkan. Oftentimes people ask the question, people who are new to Judaism, if I flick on and off a light switch on Shabbat, did I hurt anybody? Why does God care? And the truth is, if we were materialists, if we were utilitarianists, you're right. You didn't do anything. You didn't do anything. In the Olam HaChitzoni. If that switch wasn't attached to an electric chair, you're great. But in the Olam HaPnimi, when a person understands a spiritual reality, what's a Shabbat, what's kosher, what's Shatnez, to the extent that we can understand it, then we can understand that a person is doing something when they're living in a world of Torah and Mitzvot. They're constructing things in the Olam HaPnimi, even if it's not necessarily changing anything in the Olam HaChitzoni. Now, the final parting Musar for myself and for everybody, of course, is to try to develop this Olam HaPnimi. And it's hard because we really live in a Olam which is very connected to Chitzoniut in ways that a lot of us don't even really realize or think about. It was something that even occurred to me recently, right? This is my Luddite side coming out. You'll find out what a purist I am at heart. even though I'm not telling anybody to burn your computer or your cell phone or your television or whatever it is, but you see that depth of understanding that even the early Rabbanim understood with the television, right? That a television was not something that a Jew was supposed to have in his home. And it's a remarkable idea because people will tell you, well, you know, television back then was different. It was different than what television is today. And it's true. You know, the content has changed. The content back then wasn't as bad as it is today. And, you know, even that has to be taken with a grain of salt. Because, you know, I don't exactly think I would want to watch, to have my son watch Jackie Gleason say to his wife that he's going to punch her in the mouth, which was apparently funny back then. But beyond the message is the medium of television. Television is something that tells us where to look, what to see, how to feel about things. And our minds are totally caught up in a television while we're watching it. And there are just, you know, so many examples of it in our day-to-day life. You know, when you talk into a telephone, we've gotten ourselves used to, trained to, talking to machines. We talk into little plastic and metal boxes. And what happens is that we start to talk to other people like their telephones because we've gotten used to that that's how you talk to a person, but it's not. You talk to a person very differently than you talk to a little box. You know, emails and chats, we start to speak like our emails and chats. But a person reacts, there's vocal inflections, there's a face, there's a certain decency and decorum in which we communicate with one another, which is very much damaged in the reality that we live in. But for me, one of the newest sort of revelations of where this comes up in our daily life, there's a whole, I mean, even the fact that we have so many books on our bookshelf and our Bate Medrash mean that we're far less connected to the books that are there. They exist for us in the Olam HaChitzoni, and so we don't bring them into our Olam HaPnimi. But for me, I was thinking about typing. Now, I type on my computer all the time, writing things down. And I realize that I express ideas very differently when I type them than when I write them by hand. And the reason why is very easy, because I have the backspace and I have the enter and I have cut and paste. And so oftentimes I just express things, I just write them down and I say, okay, and I'll go back and I'll fix and I'll change. You remember those days of pen and paper where everything that you wrote had to be weighed so carefully, because even if it was a first draft, but there were only so many first drafts you wanted to write. And so therefore every word was written with so much more thought and consideration than the sort of just flying and letting things rip on the keyboard. So of course, I'm not trying to advocate going back to the age before books, right? If you want to read a very interesting book about it, you could read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, which would sort of be the secular philosophy stance on these ideas that we're bringing from the Jewish view of things, from the outlook of Chazal. But there's a certain sensitivity that hopefully we're able to express the importance of connecting to our inner world, of interpreting things through spirituality and not feeling bound and connected by the physical reality of these things that we see when we hear events, see events in the world, to be able to internalize them more and weigh them on a different scale through the Olam HaPnimi and not the Olam HaChitzoni. Have a great Shabbos.